Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has reconvened. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette King Bigler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Calling Daniel Dubick versus Joshua Call, 20 AP 704, appearances. Good morning. The lineup is 25 minutes, followed by 30, and back to 5 in rebuttal, correct? All right, please proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, John Monroe for the appellant. The state takes the position in this case that the statute of disorderly conduct has 8 elements. 7 different behaviors, and then the result, the tending to cause or provoke a disturbance. But both this court and the Court of Appeals have ruled on multiple occasions that there are only 2 elements for disorderly conduct, and that the behavior is collectively in one element, and that the result is another element, so that there are only 2. Because there are multiple precedents that there are only 2 elements to disorderly conduct, the state's going to have to obtain a reversal of several of those in order to win this case. And the state hasn't advanced any arguments to why both this court and the Court of Appeals precedents are both wrong and when they previously ruled that there are only 2 elements. But even if the state is correct, that means there are 7 different crimes of disorderly conduct in Wisconsin. Now, Mr. Dubeck was charged with being violent, abusive, and otherwise disorderly, but we don't know what he was convicted of because we don't have the jury verdict and we don't have a plea colloquy. He might have pleaded guilty to only one of those, such as being abusive, but not being violent. And this, because that information is not available, there's no way for the state to demonstrate that Mr. Dubeck has been convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence.
Mr. Monroe, how would, I'm sorry to start off right with the hypothetical, but I'm going to. What if the charge in this case, it was charged under 94701 as a disorderly conduct, and the language in the charging paragraph just said that the conduct was violent, that was the first element?
So that was all he could have been convicted of? Is that what you're asking? All right. Our position is that because the statute is, quote, unquote, overbroad in the context of how the Supreme Court of the United States uses it, that disorderly conduct cannot constitute a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence.
So I just want to make sure I understand your position, because that's the way I read it from your brief as well, was that the way you're reading it and the way you're looking at the U.S. Supreme Court precedent, Mathis, that disorderly conduct could never be a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence.
That's correct, Justice Krosky. And the reason for that is because even if he had been convicted of just violent, because that's all he was ever charged with, violent doesn't necessarily require, in the statute, doesn't require a use of force in the way the U.S. Supreme Court has applied it. So, for example, in the Castleman case, the Supreme Court said that Congress must have adopted or incorporated the common law definition of force into the misdemeanor crime of domestic violence definition.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to ask you about that as well. And the way I'm looking at Castleman is that is a case that has to do with a battery and what is required in a battery. And they do talk about in Castleman, they do reference, first of all, they talk about the federal law, and there is an element, and I'm talking about 921 sub A, sub 33 sub A, an element of the use or attempted use of physical force. So I think that attempted is important. And then I think later on in Castleman, they do make reference to, they say that they're talking about domestic violence and domestic violence perpetrators, and they say, first, because perpetrators of domestic violence are then they're quoting a case. There's a quotation here, routinely prosecuted under generally applicable assault or battery laws. And then they go on only to talk about battery and not assault. You and I know we don't have assault in Wisconsin. It seems to me that the disorderly conduct is similar to assault. So in my reading of Castleman, Castleman is only talking about batteries and what is necessary for a battery when we're talking about a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, but that it is not discussing an assault or a disorderly conduct.
So I think I understand your question. You're right. There's no assault in Wisconsin. I don't think, if I understand you correctly, you're maybe suggesting that disorderly conduct in Wisconsin is maybe a substitute for assault. And if that is your suggestion, I guess my response is it's a poor substitute for assault, because an assault would have to at least be an attempt to commit a battery, and disorderly conduct, even violent disorderly conduct, does not necessarily constitute an attempt to commit a battery.
Even in the under the facts of this case, where someone's holding a 2x4 over someone else's head and is threatening to kill them.
The issue is that is in the probable cause portion of the complaint. It's not in the body of the actual complaint. But the problem is the Supreme Court has made clear that it's not permissible to look at what it calls the brute facts. In other words, the conduct that the person actually engaged in. So it wouldn't matter if Mr. Dubek had actually swung a 2x4 at his wife and missed, if all he was charged with was disorderly conduct, even violent, because in the Wisconsin statute, disorderly conduct does not have an element, even the violent one, what the Supreme Court of the United States has said is necessary, which is the kind of force in common law battery, which is unwanted touching.
Can I just
follow up?
Go right ahead.
Chief Justice Ziegler. Is it possible that Castleman is only talking about batteries, though, and they're not talking about this other area of attempted force or threats or disorderly conduct or assault? I guess that's what I'm wondering.
I guess what I'd say is they're talking about batteries, and if the state statute involved were only an assault or somehow described an attempt to commit a battery, then it would, I mean, the conduct wouldn't be the same, but from a legal standpoint, it would be the same as either it actually was successful on unwanted touching or an attempt at unwanted touching. But what I'm arguing is the disorderly conduct statute does not have as an element either actual unwanted touching or an attempt of unwanted touching. So it doesn't meet the definition of a battery or an assault at common law. So it's, in other words, it's just not good enough to constitute a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. And the only way you get there is to look at the brute facts, which the Supreme Court has said you can't do that.
Thank you.
So are you talking about the categorical approach? Are you talking about a modified categorical approach? What would you urge us to adopt?
So for disorderly conduct, well, first of all, I'd say for disorderly conduct, it doesn't matter because it can't constitute a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. But if you're going to go through the analysis from beginning to end, you'd look at disorderly conduct. First, what you do is look at the statute, and you determine if it's one crime or if it defines different crimes, some of which would qualify and some of which would not. So if you adopt the state's position that disorderly conduct really is eight elements and not just two, then you would have to decide, then you'd have to look at modified versus, categorical versus modified categorical. So if it only has one way it can be committed, which is what our position is, then you'd apply the categorical approach. And if you look at disorderly conduct, it categorically cannot constitute a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. That's the end, period. If you apply the modified categorical approach, then, as we said in our brief, really the only, you'd have to decide that each of the different behaviors is a different element of the crime so that it consists of seven different crimes. If you apply that, the only one that really you could even consider would be violent. So you would you'd have to apply the modified categorical approach to see if the person were convicted of violent or one of the other elements. But then our position is, even if you conclude that he was convicted of violent, that still can't constitute a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, because it doesn't include what the Supreme Court said it must include, which is unwanted touching, or, as Justice Kurowski's pointed out, it could be an attempted unwanted touching if there were an assault kind of component of disorderly conduct.
Are you asking if we adopt your position in this case? Are you asking that we overrule Evans and Leonard?
I think they would have to be overruled partially. I don't think you'd have to overrule the cases completely. I think you'd have to overrule them to the extent that they rule that disorderly conduct can constitute a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, and to the extent that that they hold that disorderly conduct has more than two elements. I don't think they really said that, though. I think they said it just had two. I think the state's position in this case that there are eight is somewhat novel, because I don't think either this court or the Court of Appeals has ever hinted at that, and in fact has said just the opposite. Now, Mr. Dubeck was not convicted of anything like battery or any crime that involved touching of any kind. So under Supreme Court precedent, as I've pointed out, he can't have been convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. So it wasn't appropriate to revoke his license. And the only path to victory for the state in this case is to establish that all violent disorderly conduct is a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, even without touching. And as I said, that's a novel conclusion for Wisconsin and for the nation, for that matter. The better approach would be to follow Supreme Court of the United States precedent, which is, if, as I've said with Chief Justice Ziegler, if there are eight elements, then you have to use the modified categorical approach. But then the state loses because of what I had just described above. And if there are only two elements, then each of the behaviors listed in the statute is just an alternate means of committing disorderly conduct, and you have to use the categorical approach if each of the different means of committing the crime are just an alternate means and not alternate elements.
So in our statutes, there can be penalty enhancers for domestic violence crimes, and I think penalty enhancers could apply to disorderly conduct. Would your analysis change if that penalty enhancer were charged?
Well, I guess I'm not sure that's enough. Those are enough facts for me to say. And if you were charged with something that included a penalty enhancer, which is, I mean, is a separate statute. If he'd been charged and convicted with all of that, I don't think
would it still boil down to whether the penalty enhancer is an element?
It would. And then if it were, whether that element would include the use of force as described by the Supreme Court of the United States. So, for example, if there were a penalty enhancer for being domestic, that's not good enough, because it still doesn't include the use of force being unwanted touching. There might be some other penalty enhancer that could turn it into a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, but I don't know offhand what that is. One thing to think about when deciding whether a certain crime is has alternate means or alternate elements is whether the crime has different punishments. So I think what you were talking about, Chief Justice Ziegler, is if there are different punishments, maybe that really creates a separate crime. But again, you have to look at the elements and whether force is involved. But in the case of Wisconsin, at least just for disorderly conduct with no enhancers added to it, it's just one crime, because all the different means of committing it, they're all in the same paragraph, they're all punished the same, they're all treated the same, and this court has ruled that when the legislature groups a bunch of behaviors together into the same paragraph and treats them all the same, that they're, as a matter of public policy, conceptually similar, and so they are just but a single element of the crime. And that's the case that we have here for disorderly conduct. I also want to point out in Castleman, the Supreme Court acknowledged that during the legislative debates over the Lautenberg Amendment, which is the misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, the language was actually changed from what was originally filed. And before it was passed, Congress said, according to the Supreme Court in Castleman, the bill was changed to address the fear that Section 922 G9, which is the misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, might be triggered by offenses in which no force at all was directed at a person. It's clear then from the Supreme Court's analysis of what Congress did is that Congress wanted to confine the Lautenberg Amendment to only circumstances where actual force was directed at a person and not to, for example, an inanimate object or personal property, which the state has suggested would apply. That kind of eliminates disorderly conduct as being a potential misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, because if the force has to be directed at a person, then it's clear in our disorderly conduct statute that there's no requirement that there be a person who is a victim of the disorderly conduct. The statute's not written that way. That's not how complaints are written, because if a person is just disorderly, there doesn't even have to be a victim, and a person could be a victim of something kind of tangential or corollary, like if property were damaged, the owner of the property could say, well, I was a victim of that crime, which is true in the, like in the context of restitution or something like that, but he's not really the victim of the crime, because the way the statute's worded, there doesn't have to be a victim, and there frequently is not a victim of disorderly conduct.
I'm going to push back a little bit on that.
Okay.
I'm having a hard time seeing how in a domestic situation, and I think the I don't know of a domestic violence enhancer. There is certainly a domestic violence surcharge, and that's under 973.055, and that attaches, of course, to any crime that is committed by an adult person against her or, excuse me, against his or her spouse or former spouse, against an adult or against an adult with whom the adult person has created a child, which is the same definition of domestic abuse in 968.075, the mandatory arrest statute. In any case, in any disorderly conduct case that is domestic in nature, how could there not be a victim? I'm not following your... In any disorderly conduct case that is charged by the DA, where the DA also adds the domestic abuse surcharge, how could there not be a victim?
I'm not sure. Well, I don't know. I guess it would... I haven't thought about that, and to be candid, I mean, that's not something the state brought up. Maybe that there has to be a victim, but it could be, I would think, that one, like if it were a spouse, we'll just say spouse on spouse, that one spouse's property were damaged, I think that would constitute domestic abuse or domestic violence under the statute, but there still isn't necessarily a victim who suffered physically, personally, as opposed to the victim's property.
But Mr. Monroe, let me give you a hypothetical.
Okay.
It isn't so hypothetical because I've seen it. A situation where there is domestic abuse in a family and a child calls the police and the police come and everyone tells the police what happened. And in the scenario I'm thinking about, the dad was arrested and was taken to jail, then bailed out and came home. Everyone woke up the next morning, and the family dog had been killed. Everyone in that house, no one has been touched. Everyone knows that the father killed the dog to send the message to everyone else. which is, you know, really what they talk about. They talk about this in Castleman, about these are my words, not what the U.S. Supreme Court says in Castleman, but it's little by little, right? Mm-hmm. It's these little blocks and little blocks that all build up to be domestic abuse. So I have a hard time understanding the argument that domestic violence is only when someone has contact with someone else. Think about stalking. How is that not domestic? So I'm not completely following you.
I think maybe the disconnect is you're thinking of domestic violence maybe in a colloquial or non-legal way, and I'm sticking with a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, all in capital letters, as Congress has defined it.
How is domestic violence defined for 922G purposes?
It's defined in the federal statute, I think it's 921A33, it's quoted and cited in our briefs, but it has, I think there are three elements. It has to be a misdemeanor. That's not an issue in this case. Disorderly conduct is a misdemeanor. It has to have a force element, and I'm going to jump back to that because that's really the one that's at issue in this case.
Or attempted force, which I think is really important.
You're right, force or attempted force. And then the third one is there has to be a certain relationship. And we'll, for the purposes of this case, say that Mr. Dubek's wife was the victim of disorderly conduct to the extent there can be a victim but in disorderly conduct, but we'll say that we'll stipulate it for this case. So the only thing that's really at issue is whether there was force or not. And the Supreme Court of the United States has said that force, as used by Congress in the definition, intended to incorporate the common law definition of battery of unwanted touching. So the force that's used to accomplish a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence has to be either unwanted touching, and that's of a person, not of property, or an attempted unwanted touching in the case of an assault or an attempt. So our position is that under the disorderly conduct statute, even under the violent provision of it, it has to have as an element the use of force. It can't just be, well, if you read the probable cause section of the complaint, oh, it's clear that he used force. It actually has to be an element of the crime. And disorderly conduct in Wisconsin does not have unwanted touching or an attempted unwanted touching baked into the disorderly conduct statute. So that's why we come to the conclusion that disorderly conduct cannot constitute a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence as defined under federal law.
Go ahead. Finish up.
Well, I was just going to turn back to Justice Borowski and finish my thought to her. That's why we have the position that that's why I was saying I think maybe we're talking about two different things. What you're describing certainly is conduct that we want to address as a society, and there may be different statutes that can or should address that. But as Congress has defined a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, what you describe would not constitute one. That's our position.
So if we agree with you on that first issue, do we need to get to your second issue about the service and the response of the Department of Justice?
I don't think we need to, Justice Dalladam. I think if you agree with us on the merits, we don't really need to.
Is it a fair summarization of your argument in response to Justice Karofsky's questions that her concerns would have to be addressed by a legislative fix? In other words, the legislature would have to redefine a crime or define a crime of disorderly conduct that brings into the definition of the crime an element of violence or force.
Certainly, that would be one way to address it, or the legislature could just create a new crime that would maybe address that. But I'm not sure that it could ever be written so that in her hypothetical, it would be a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. Perhaps it could be, but because what she described didn't involve any unwanted touching or even attempted unwanted touching of a victim who fits the relationship requirement, I don't think it could be. Unless there are any other questions, I'll waive the rest of my time and come back for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Assistant Attorney General Brian Keenan on behalf of Attorney General Call. So I'd like to just start with the statutory language of the misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, which is the definition is in 18 U.S.C. 921A33, and the key part is sub 2. It's a misdemeanor, but then it has as an element the use or attempted use of physical force. And so we've talked a lot about Castleman, the Castleman case. What Castleman held was that a crime of battery under a state that required just the bare minimum of touching was sufficient to meet that definition. However, in doing that, it said that, and relying on its former case in Johnson, that the word violent connotes the use of physical force. So that's why our position is that the violent prong in the disorderly conduct statute does connote physical force.
So do we have to overturn any cases if we rule in your favor? Because I don't think we really require juries to reach a conclusion on which of the parts of the first element they are unanimous on.
Well, I think there was an unpublished Court of Appeals. I don't think that would require any over-precedential. I think I don't think you would need to overrule any cases because under the general rule of what's an element versus what's a means, there's been the cases cited in both briefs, you know, like Lamagro and type of cases deal with whether the conduct is substantially similar or substantially different. So applying that general rule here, we don't see that violent conduct is very much similar to unreasonably loud conduct or.
So you think there are 8 elements?
We think there's alternative elements. So there's
Haven't we always defined disorderly conduct as having 2 elements? And the jury does not need unanimity on whether it's violent or otherwise disorderly or indecent or profane. They just need to reach consensus on each of the 2 elements separately proven beyond a reasonable doubt by the state, right?
Well, I don't know that that's been specifically decided. I think that, you know, there was a unpublished Court of Appeals decision that said there didn't need to be jury unanimity. I don't know that that was specifically decided by this court.
If they were different elements, how could you not have
No, you would need jury unanimity if they're different elements.
So how does this work? All these judges for all these years and continuing give these alternatives, so if we rule in your favor, we would have to say that there's no longer, you can't give these alternatives. You'd have to have unanimity, so that they would have to pick a way to define disorderly conduct. You couldn't say violent, abusive, or otherwise disorderly conduct. In this case, it was an and, but.
Yeah, you could not do an or, no, that's
so
correct.
We would be, you want us to say that these are different elements.
Yes.
What's your best argument for why each of these potentially alternate means of committing an offense are instead elements?
Well, the rule is that whether they're substantially similar or substantially different, we don't see that violent conduct is very similar to boisterous conduct or is substantially similar to unreasonably loud conduct. Abusive conduct, they're all quite different. In the case law where there's a finding that they're alternative means, they're very similar, like attempted use of force or the use of force. There's different types of sexual contact that constituted sexual assault. And so in those, it was found that there was similar behavior. There didn't need to be jury unanimity because they were similar. Here, if there's not, these are not quite very similar at all.
So otherwise disorderly is not similar to violent, abusive, boisterous, profane?
Unreasonably loud.
Unreasonably loud. It's somehow different?
Yeah, violent is quite different from unreasonably loud.
So if you're right, counsel, a jury instruction that was submitted that had listed violent, abusive, and otherwise disorderly conduct, or otherwise disorderly conduct, take your pick, that would be reversible error because you wouldn't have jury unanimity on which one of those elements that the person committed. If your argument is that each of those are separate elements that would need to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, so the sort of standard jury instructions that existed prior to this would really have led to all sorts of reversible convictions, I presume.
Well, it depends how they did it, but you would need to have unanimity on each of the right. each of the elements.
So in this situation, imagine Mr. Dubek's it was violent, abusive, or otherwise, and or otherwise.
Yeah,
but I don't know that it matters for your purposes whether it said and or, because your argument is each one of those needs to have unanimity. And in fact, in order for him to have been, you know, prohibited from getting his CCW license here, the jury would have had to have concluded that it was violent, and I suppose accept your other argument that violence always necessarily includes the physical force required under federal law.
Well, this is a plea bargain, so there was no jury finding in this case. So, and under the Evans case, we've been applying it where when there's a plea with an or, it's not proven which one was admitted to, whereas when a plea with an and, it is admitted to all of them, and so therefore it's counts.
But would you, if it had been submitted to the jury, would you agree that that would be error for a jury instruction that lists violent, abusive, or otherwise disorderly conduct? If that were submitted under element one to the jury, that that's insufficient because the jury needs to conclude which one of those. You're arguing they're each alternative elements, and therefore we really have seven different crimes here.
If it's or, yes, then that's error.
Counsel, your argument then indicates to me that the jury instruction 1900, disorderly conduct, criminal, is a problem.
Wrong.
It is wrong. And that the committee, the committee's advice and how this operates is also wrong. I refer to the jury instruction committee. On page 4 of the instruction, the committee recommends selecting one of the terms in parentheses where possible, but believes it is proper to instruct on all alternatives that are supported by the evidence. Is that an incorrect admonition?
Well, I think selecting one would not be incorrect.
No,
multiple, if they're jumbled together, then yes, but if there was a separate for each, then that would not be incorrect.
When you say jumbled together, I'm not quite sure.
Well, you could have an instruction that said, did Mr. Dubek engage in violent conduct tending to cause a disturbance? Another instruction that said, did Mr. Dubek engage in boisterous conduct?
You're saying that the DA would have to charge several different counts.
Well, I think they can charge one count because it's alternate elements of the same crime, but they would have to prove each of them up. So I think you could charge them in one, but you'd have to, in the complaint, for purposes of charging him. But I think that the conviction, you would have to prove which one was found guilty of.
Okay, if they're alternate elements, why couldn't he be convicted of each of them separately?
I think he could, yes.
How could you send all of those to the jury?
Well, it could be multiple disorderly conduct convictions then. So
but
for him, he would have three convictions in your mind.
Well, he pled guilty to one count. So I think he,
right.
On the plea, it was pled guilty to one.
But it could have
one.
Been three is what you're saying.
Right. Imagine if the DA had charged them in are you done? I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Imagine if the DA had charged one count, and in the charging paragraph it said violent, abusive, and otherwise disorderly conduct. You're saying that the jury instruction, 1900, you'd have to have three of those that would go to the jury, and the jury could find him guilty or not guilty of one, two, or three offenses. But then he would only be convicted of one. It would be like the OWI law, where you can be convicted of OWI and PAC, and one would be dismissed or something. Like, I don't understand how the DA can charge one crime. If the state charges one crime, and then the jury convicts of three crimes, what do you do with that?
In terms of, like, sentencing? Or you mentioned OWI.
How is that fair? Right, for anything.
Well, I think there was just alternate ways that he had violated the same crime, the same statute. There's alternate elements, so they could charge multiple variations of the same crime.
Okay, it sounds like you're saying alternate means. I don't know about what alternate elements are. It seems like you're creating a new, something new for us to call something alternate elements, because they're elements or they're alternate means, right? But you want us to say that they're elements, in which case there would be three crimes.
Yes.
Okay.
Counsel, on page 5 of the reply brief of opposing counsel, the brief furthers this discussion by saying the state is advancing that there are seven conducts that are separate elements, and gives the example, this brief gives the example, that is, you could have boisterous under circumstances that tend to cause or provoke a disturbance, or you could have unreasonably loud under circumstances that tend to cause or provoke a disturbance. Each is a separate crime under your theory, the state's theory. Page 5 on the brief continues, presumably a person could be convicted of two counts of disorderly conduct for being boisterous and unreasonably loud under circumstances that tend to cause or provoke a disturbance. Is your opposing counsel correctly characterizing the consequences of your argument?
I think with alternative elements, yes, you could be convicted of different elements of the same in that list.
So the hypothetical that is posed, that a person could be convicted of two counts of disorderly conduct for being boisterous and for being unreasonably loud. Is that your position?
I mean, boisterous and unreasonably loud seem fairly similar under the general test for what's a means and an element. So I think someone would have an argument there that those are too similar to be separate elements.
Well, are there or are there not seven conducts that are separate elements?
Well, our position is that we think that they are separate elements. I don't know that boisterous and unreasonably loud, since it wasn't really at issue here, we think that violent is very different from those two.
So maybe there really are only six separate?
It could be that some of them are so similar that they're not separate elements under the, you know, kind of governing case law and what's an element versus what's a means.
The way you separate a means into an element is if the words chosen by the legislature are conceptually distinct. Is that the test? And if you do that, then do you, under Supreme Court precedent, say you have a divisible statute that you're dealing with?
Yeah, so that's how it comes into play under the categorical approach, is whether they are separate elements, in which case, or alternative elements when you can do a divisible approach. If not, then you can't
but
go there.
If you get to the divisible approach, which is kind of what I think you're doing,
mm-hmm.
we don't have a lot of records here to determine which one was the basis for the plea, because we can't really look at the complaint. That doesn't help us. But I understand that there aren't any records from this conviction. That I was just looking at the U.S. Supreme Court trying to figure out what things do you have to show in order to go where you're going. And you have to determine what he necessarily admitted to. And you can do that if you have a written plea agreement, which we don't have. Right?
Correct.
And you can do that from notes of the hearing that was held, which we don't have. I guess I'm kind of wondering what record are you relying on for us to say, yes, this is a divisible statute, and he pled to the violent element. What can we look at? I didn't find any.
So there's a limited class of documents,
right, that's
the court
right.
says, that you can look at. One is the charging document you can look at, so we can look at the complaint.
You think that's enough?
And the judgment of conviction, in which he pled guilty to count one of the complaint. So that lists the elements. It lists violent and so the judgment showing the plead guilty to that count and then the complaint that shows the count we think is sufficient under the categorical approach.
Okay. We can't look at the facts in the complaint, right? We can only look at the charging paragraph at the top.
In terms of determining what crime was committed or what the conviction is, you can't look at the facts of the complaint. You can look at facts to determine the victim relationship. That's not covered by the, but in terms of the crime that was committed and that was convicted of, you can't.
So regardless of whether we take your approach of their separate elements or your opponent's approach that their means, either way, at the end of the day, violence has to equate to the definition under federal law.
Yes.
Tell me your best argument about why it always includes force or attempted force, because it would always have to do it since we can't look at the facts to see whether it did here or not. So tell me why violence is always force or attempted force.
Yeah. So our best argument is based on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Castleman and Johnson, which it said that the word violent standing alone connotes a substantial. There's dictionary definitions that were relied on in Johnson and other dictionary definitions that show violent means use of force. And so what the federal statute requires is that it has as an element the use or attempted use of physical force. We think violent connotes that, use of physical force. It means use of physical force.
But counsel, in Castleman, the Johnson case was referring to a violent felony, and the question, you know, was a different kind of question. And that's what the Supreme Court was explaining in Castleman, but the same principles applied. The Court of Appeals in their certification say, listen, Castleman is pretty clear. And admittedly, right, you're correct, and certainly in your argument, in your briefing, that it's a different factual context. But the Court of Appeals says physical force means offensive touching. That's what the U.S. Supreme Court in Castleman says. You say, no, it isn't that. But the operative question is not – the operative question is physical force. And what does physical force mean under federal law? Mm-hmm. You say I don't know that I got from your brief what physical force means in your view under federal law. I hear you saying it doesn't always mean offensive touching, but what does it mean?
Yeah, and so what in the Castleman case, and it mentioned that, or the Johnson case, it mentioned that physical force means force exerted by or through concrete bodies as opposed to intellectual force or emotional force. So we think violent means that there's force being exerted by the person who's guilty of this violent conduct. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean to be like someone hit someone else. It could be that their violent conduct is, you know, like punching a hole in the wall. Like, it could be that the violent conduct is, you know, something forceful like that. And that's, so the use of the term violent in the disorderly conduct statute means that includes physical force. And so you should only be guilty of violent conduct like that if there was physical force involved.
So if I, so somebody gets in an argument with their spouse, they start yelling and screaming, they take a plate and throw it against the wall. That would be enough to secure a conviction under the violent prong of disorderly conduct, and you would also say definitely meets the definition of physical force under federal law.
Yes.
And what I didn't see anything in your brief. What is your best case that is true? Nothing. I didn't find anything. Castleman certainly doesn't say that. Castleman talks about exerting force, but it always makes the connection to offensive touching. The point it makes when it's using the language you're quoting is that forcing somebody to drink poison or hitting something with an object is using a kind of force against another person. Castleman doesn't, as I read it, have any connection to force against something that's directed against somebody, something other than a particular victim. Do you have any cases out there that define it the way you're defining it?
I don't think there's a federal case that defines it that way. I would say that, so what the way the statute works is it says the crime has as an element the use or attempted use of physical force and then some deadly weapon, but then it says committed by a current or former spouse, which would be the relevant one here, of the victim. So what the federal statute says, there needs to be a victim and there needs to be an element, the use of force. So under Castleman's expansive definition of domestic violence, would like a spouse who's been subjected to that, would they be a victim of the force? And I think we can say yes, even if that plate did not hit them in the head, but the plate flew by their head and hit the wall. I think that's consistent with what Castleman is talking about the nature of domestic violence. I think in some ways the statute is somewhat unique in that I don't know that there are a lot of statutes that have like a violent conduct kind of like prong as opposed to just a battery or an assault or some sort of.
Have you had a chance to finish your answer?
Yes.
Okay. I think Justice Rogenczyk would like to ask a question.
Yeah, I want to go back to the complaint because I'm trying to understand your arguments about the statute being a divisible statute, and I have the complaint in front of me, and I'm trying to determine if I can, without looking at the facts, just looking at basically the first paragraph, and what it says is the defendant did engage in violent, abusive, and otherwise disorderly conduct under circumstances in which the conduct tended to provoke a disturbance. Well, they've got violent, they've got abusive, and they've got otherwise disorderly. And I want you to try to help me know why I should think that what has been said there is an allegation of the use of force.
Well, because it says violent.
But it says other things, too.
And it says and, so all three of those. And when you plead guilty to that count that says all three of those occurred, you're pleading guilty to violent. And so, therefore, it's a physical.
I know, but when you're looking at trying to line up what was pled and what was admitted, you have to be, if you're going to separate the statute into parts, as you're doing, we don't have any narration that talks about what happened there. I read the complaint, so I know what happened. But that's not what we have that we can look at with the alternate categorical approach. So I'm looking at the first paragraph of the complaint. The judgment of conviction tells you zero in regard to anything except that he pled to disorderly conduct. But it doesn't tell you which part, and the pleadings, I'm having trouble telling me which part. Do you see my trouble?
Yes.
Okay, so how can I... Well, you go ahead and see if you can fix it. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I think the best we can do is say that he was charged with violent and otherwise disorderly conduct in count one. There's another count which was dropped as part of the plea, mm-hmm. pled guilty to count one. So therefore, he's pled to violent and disorderly conduct, and therefore has been convicted of the violent prong, and that necessarily implies the use of force. I think that's, and just the way the categorical approach works, you don't look at what any of those facts in the complaint really, all you need to know is what was the crime of conviction.
But basically under the categorical approach, the way it's pled makes it an overbroad pleading. And if you have an overbroad pleading under the categorical approach, you don't get into this divisibility that we've been talking about back and forth and that are in, well, I don't know, is it DeCamps that talks about the divisibility?
Yeah. I don't think it's overbroad pleading in the sense that it mentions violent and we think he's necessarily pled guilty to that.
But if so, that's all we get to look at, if there was another document, if there was a transcript from what was said at the time of the plea, we might be able to do better, but I don't see how that's not overbroad.
Well, I think those are the documents in the record that we have. So
that's
I think
it.
That,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, this case was from like 1990.
Yeah, I know.
I think.
It was from
so
a long
just,
time ago.
It's,
I
there's
agree.
Aren't as many documents remaining.
So. Mr. Keenan, if we are not able to get on board with your argument that the seven ways of committing domestic violence are separate elements, Do you lose?
Yes, because then it's a overbroad statute, and it wouldn't meet the categorical approach of the U.S. Supreme Court. It'd kind of be like the burglary statute in Iowa, which was at issue in Mathis. It would be like that circumstance. So,
go ahead. You go ahead.
Thank you. Which one did he plead to? Or did he plead to three crimes that day? Did he plead to violent behavior, abusive behavior, or otherwise disorderly conduct under circumstances in which such conduct tended to cause or provoke a disturbance? Which one did he plead to that day, or did he plead to all three?
I think all three.
So we have three convictions. Does the judgment of conviction, which I don't have in front of me, I only have the complaint in front of me, does the judgment of conviction indicate he pled to three crimes, and was he sentenced on three crimes of disorderly conduct?
It said he pled guilty to 947-01, count one, 947-011.
And does the judgment of conviction reflect that he was given a sentence for one crime or three crimes that day?
I don't know. I don't know. I'd have to.
Okay.
It's for one, I can tell you, and I have it in my.
Okay. That would be my guess. Yep.
Counsel, would you at least acknowledge that the argument you're making on disorderly conduct here would work a pretty significant change from the way it's been previously understood?
It seems like perhaps it would have some changes to what the way district attorneys are pleading or are charging it, and perhaps I don't know how many of these actually go to a jury trial since it's a misdemeanor, but to the extent they were having jury instructions that just listed them all, then it would be a change. I think I've covered what I had planned to cover, so if there's any questions, I can answer them, or I can.
All right. I think you're all set. Mm-hmm. Battle?
So I just want to cover a few of the points raised with the discussion with the state. One is, if disorderly conduct really consists of multiple elements and then, by extension, multiple crimes, under 971.12(1), two or more crimes may be charged in the same complaint in a separate count for each crime. So if what Mr. Keenan is saying is that the state charges, like in this case with Mr. Dubek, three different crimes all in one count, that's not permissible under the statute. Now, it's also fundamentally unfair because it raises, especially if there's not jury unanimity, because it raises issues of double jeopardy, for instance. And in this particular case, as Justice Bradley was asking about, we don't know what he pleaded guilty to. We have the complaint and we have a judgment of conviction, but we don't know what happened in between. He might have gone to court and said, I was abusive that day, and I'll plead guilty to that, but I'm not pleading guilty to being violent or being otherwise disorderly. That might have happened. We don't know. There's just one judgment of conviction. There aren't three. And then something, Chief Justice Ziegler, that you asked about was whether any cases would have to be overruled. I think several would have to be if you rule for the state. You'd have to overrule Evans and Leonard for sure, at least to the extent that they say disorderly conduct only has two elements. And then this court also in State versus Breitzman ruled or agreed that disorderly conduct only has two elements. You'd have to overrule your own precedent on that as well. And of course, I'll point out the state successfully argued in the cited but unpublished decision of the Court of Appeals in Galerowitz that disorderly conduct just consists of alternative means and juror unanimity is not required. The last thing I want to point out is when the legislature, this court has ruled that when the legislature groups alternatives to committing a crime together into the same paragraph, that as a matter of public policy, they're determined to be conceptually similar. So this court's already basically set the precedent that the way the disorderly conduct statute is worded, they're separate means, or they're different means and not separate elements. Thank you. That's all I have, unless there are other questions.
I don't know if there are other questions, but just by way of cleaning up any potential administrative type issues, you're a lawyer in Georgia?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you also a lawyer in Wisconsin?
Yes, I am.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure we didn't need to deal with Pro Hoc Vitae issues.
No. I actually went to law school at the University of Wisconsin and was admitted here.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure we didn't have a problem.
And we made you come back in the winter.
Well, it wasn't the first time and probably won't be the last.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll adjourn. 1:30.